we have a Vaishnav Institutes kind of a union, reunion or the last get together. And then tomorrow night I'm going to Lucknow for a couple of days. I'm coming back on 23rd. 23rd is Govardhan Puja. I don't think anyone will be here for the class. Then 24th, we actually have a Vaishnava etiquette class starting at 10 o'clock. And it's open to all. And that class may go on for about 2 hours. So I don't think after that I'll have, or you know, anybody else will have it. Enthusiasm to listen to me. And then 24th. 25th is a meeting, and also 25th is a parikrama. 26th is Prabhupada's disappearance, the celebration. And so it seems that it's not going to be practical to, I mean, had I not have gone to Lucknow, then I could have given 2 more classes. Oh, yes.
You said 24 is a class by Shanghai.
Yeah. Oh. Open to all. Yeah. This, so that will be at 10 o'clock.
Yes.
Here.
Okay.
Yeah.
This classroom?
In this classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And can I get a, Purushottam, can I get your pen and paper? Because I was... Who all gave, who all submitted, yeah. I can tell me better. Who all submitted papers here? Jagannath, Bruce, did you submit, we had some kind of, I gave some homework before. You gave any paper? No. You gave. What's your name?
Bhakta
Louis. L-U-I-C? That's how you spell? Louis?
L-U-I-C?
L-O-U-I-S. No, it's French. L-O-U-I-C? Anyway, I got your name. Sorry. And who else came? There was one boy called Prabodhananda. And yeah, he gave, what's his name? Bhakta from France. Another
Bhakta
Orleans. Him, yeah? Yeah, how do you spell his name? O-R? A-U-R? O-N? Orleans? Or a Leon, L-I-E-N. Okay, and then from there, yeah, and Mother Vegavati, your name is not
Guru
Prashant. Yes. And Namamrita? Namakrishna. Oh yeah. Namakrishna. Who else? This chair is breaking. So who else gave? Do you remember? No, its chair is breaking. Yeah. Sarga. Any? Can you remember anyone else? So, today we are going to discuss about the third verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, first chapter, I had been mentioning that these first three verses are very, very important. And they are, first one is, which one is the first verse? Who remembers? And then? Very good. And the second one? Yeah, let somebody else say that. Did you submit your paper? No, you? Yeah, you did. Yeah, what's the second verse? No one? Please memorize them. Memorize these three verses, very important. Anyone from this side? And the third one? The second one is, anyway, since there is no one, you recite. But do it slowly.
Dharma prajita krista bhutta paramoni masya manasitam vejyamra samanatrava sushva santapartaya namunam srimad bhagavati maha muni krite kiva para yusara saduri jiva jyoti taki chudishu dushu
vishakshu. Very good. It's actually important that we memorize these shlokas. Well, one thing is very effective for preaching. Like when we quote Sanskrit shlokas, people get very impressed. Like, can you imagine how impressed you will get if some American is giving a lecture and then all of a sudden he starts quoting Chinese scriptures? How will it sound to you? Won't you be impressed? At least I'll be impressed. So, the same way, when you quote Sanskrit, people get, even Indians get impressed. I mean, you may quote just one shloka, but they'll think that you are a Sanskrit scholar. And it's a fact. Like, long time ago, when I was just a new devotee at that time, so I met a man, he was a businessman, and he was telling me that how one Canadian devotee came to his office, and he was such a great Sanskrit scholar. And I immediately thought of two persons, a Jayapataka Maharaj or a Hiranyagarbha Prabhu, because both they are from Canada, and both of them spent a long time in India, and both of them knew Sanskrit very well. But then when I asked them, actually then I found out that it was neither of them. And then finally I found out that it was a new devotee. But he just quoted one or two shlokas like Sarvadharman Parityajya and so on and so forth. And the man was so impressed that he thought that this devotee was a very great Sanskrit scholar. So the same way when you preach, and if you quote a few Sanskrit shlokas, people do get very impressed. And besides that, please don't mind my undue criticism, but in spite of being in this movement for so many years, if we don't even remember the first three shlokas of Srimad Bhagavatam, it's not a very good indication. It's a good habit, I can suggest, that you note down a few shlokas and once every day you just read through them. You don't have to memorize them. Just read, get, you know, 10-12 shlokas to begin with, important shlokas, and write them in a notebook or make a special sloka book and read them. And you'll see that within, although it is difficult to memorize one shloka a day, but by doing that, very easily you can memorize about 30 shlokas a month. You don't even have to make any endeavor, just read it once a day. And you will see it yourself. And then when you have become a little proficient in memorizing shlokas, then you can make it a point to read a chapter of Bhagavad Gita every day for a month. Like first chapter for 1 month, then read the second chapter for the next month. And also you'll see that at the end of the month, you have almost memorized the entire chapter. And that's how within 1.5 years, very easily you can memorize the entire Bhagavad Gita. 18 chapters for 18 months. In India, people usually do that. Like you'll find, they're not very educated, but they memorize, they remember entire Bhagavad Gita. They have memorized from the first chapter to the last chapter. And it doesn't really take so much of an endeavor. Yes, Jagannath.
Anybody
understand
the Bhagavad Gita? Anybody?
Is
this kind of
Bhagavad Gita? Yes.
Really?
Quite a few.
Yeah.
Right. I went to South India. One devotee took me to his sister's house. And they are so-called karnis. Right. And her daughters, she has 3 daughters. And they'll be about, say, between, at that time they were between, say, 9 to 14 or so, 15. And they, all 3 of them know entire Bhagavad Gita. And right in front of me, they recited 1 chapter each. So it's very impressive. It doesn't really take very long. So the 3rd shloka is the Nigama Kalpatarur. Golitam Phalam. Oh, does anyone know the 3rd one? Besides you. So, Guruji, make it a point to memorize the shlokas, right? Purushottam Prabhu also. Anyone from the Mataji's side? Okay, so please memorize them. So the shloka goes like Nigama Kalpa Tarur Golitam Phalam Sukha Mukhad Amrita Drava Sangyutam Pivata Bhagavata Rasam Alayam Muhuraho Roshika Bhubi Bhavuka. The translation is, O expert and thoughtful man, relish Srimad Bhagavatam, the mature fruit of the desire tree of Vedic literatures. It emanated from the lips of Sri Shukadev Goswami. Therefore, this fruit has become even more tasteful, although its nectarian juice was already relishable for all, including liberated souls. Addressing the expert and thoughtful men and asking them to relish Srimad Bhagavatam. And what is Srimad Bhagavatam? Srimad Bhagavatam is the Nigama Kalpatarur Golitam Phalam. Nigama means Nigama Vedic literatures. And Kalpatarur, Kalpataru, desire trees. And here it is Kalpa Taro, desire trees. The desire, actually it should be plural. And these are trees. Oh no, it's alright. It's off the tree, so then it's tolerable. Golitam. Golitam means ripened. Phalam means fruit. So this Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the desire tree of Vedic literature. Why the Vedas have been compared to a desire tree? Why? What does the desire tree do?
Satisfy all desires.
Right. Satisfies all desires. And the Vedic literatures also, the Vedas also satisfy or can satisfy all our desires if we properly approach the Vedas. Nigama Kalpataru Golitam Phalam. That Kalpataru is the Vedic literatures and the ripened fruit of that tree is Srimad Bhagavatam. That's such a wonderful analogy. You can well imagine that how wonderful the desire tree is. You can just go to a desire tree and you can ask, give me a Mercedes Benz, and the desire tree can give you that. So, actually desire tree can fulfill all your desires. But of course desire trees in Vrindavan fulfills only desires that are Krishna conscious or spiritual. Material desires, like the trees in the other day one devotee asked me that the trees in Vrindavan are also, this is Vrindavan and the trees are actually desire trees. Then why can't we get the advantage of these trees? Like they do not supply us according to our demands. The answer is, you know, our demands are actually not Krishna conscious. That's why real Vrindavan is not manifest. We have too many material desires. We have not as yet developed Krishna consciousness. That's why Vrindavan is not manifest. And that's why these trees are also not manifest as desire trees. But when you become purified, they will fulfill all our desires. Now, desire tree can fulfill all our desires. Now, how wonderful must be the fruit of that tree? Like, the tree that fulfills all our desires, the fruit of that tree must be so wonderful. Nigama Kalpatarur Golitam Phalam. And that fruit again is very ripe, mature, Golitam. And not only that, Sukha Mukhad Amrita Drava Sangyutam. This fruit has been blended with the nectar from Sukadeva Goswami's lotus mouth. Sukadeva Goswami spoke this Bhagavatam. This Bhagavatam was originally composed by Vyasadeva, and then Sukadeva Goswami recited this Srimad Bhagavatam to Parikshit Maharaj and the sages, those who were assembled there. And Suta Goswami also was present. So Suta Goswami heard from Shukadeva Goswami. Golitam phalam sukha mukhad amrita drava samyutam pivata bhagavata rasamalayam. Rasam means mellow. Rasam alayam. Alayam means source. And this Bhagavatam is the source of all the transcendental mellows. And pivata means drink. This wonderful nectar of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the source or reservoir of all the transcendental mellows, is drunk by the rasikas, mugurapo Rasika. Muhu means always, constant. Rasika means people who know, people who know how to relish the rasas. Rasa and rasika. One who knows how to relish mellows is called rasika. And bhubi, bhavuka. Bhavuka means thoughtful being. So is it clear? The meaning of this shlok? I'll repeat it again. O expert and thoughtful man, relish Srimad Bhagavatam, the mature fruit of the desire tree of Vedic literatures. It emanated from the lips of Sri Shukadeva Goswami. Therefore, this fruit has become even more tasteful. Although its nectarian juice was already relishable for all, including liberated souls. Although this Bhagavatam was relishable even by the liberated souls, but still the Bhagavatam became even more relishable ever since it has been blended with the nectar from Sukadeva Goswami's mouth. Of course, Prabhupada did not literally translate that. Prabhupada translated that it emanated from the lips of Sri Shukadeva Goswami. Because the less intelligent or less conversant readers could not understand what it is that blended with the nectar from the lotus lips of, or lotus mouth of Sukadeva Goswami. They could not understand that. On the other hand, they may have been disgusted or repulsed that, my God, he ate that fruit and now he's offering it to me. So, but when something is touched by the lips of a pure devotee, then it becomes even more relishable. And all the prasad that we take is actually mixed with Krishna's nectar from Krishna's mouth. Literally you can say the saliva from Krishna's mouth. And devotees will become even more, devotees will just become ecstatic just by hearing that it has been blended with the saliva or the juice from Krishna's mouth. So, last time I gave a class on this. Actually, I gave the class on these three shlokas on the very beginning of this class. We started on the 21st. On the 21st. And the first day I gave the summary of Srimad Bhagavatam. The first canto. The first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then I explained these three verses, the first, second and third, on three consecutive days. But I was requested by some devotees to repeat this class, these three classes. And so, today is the third shlok. Actually, it's a very important shlok. These three shloks are very, very important. Like, just on the first shlok, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave lectures for a couple of months. Just on one shlok, he just explained that one shlok for 2 months. Maybe even longer, I'm not quite sure about that. So it's a very, these shlokas are very important. And by understanding these verses, we can get a rather, complete or comprehensive understanding of Srimad Bhagavatam. So here it's actually a very important or very interesting consideration that why the Vedas have been considered compared to the Kalpa Vrikshas, and this Bhagavatam has been considered to be the ripened fruit of this, the tree of Vedic literatures. The Vedas actually can fulfill all our desires. If we approach the Vedas properly, then Vedas will fulfill all our desires. Like, if somebody wants to become very rich, if he approaches the Vedas, then the Vedas will give him direction how to become rich. And he will become rich. If somebody wants to become the king of the entire earth planet, he can become the king by following the Vedas. What to talk about the earth planet? If somebody wants to become the king of the heavenly planets, he can also get that position. What to talk about the heavenly planets? If somebody wants to get the position of Brahma, that's also possible by following the Vedas. So we can see that the Vedas actually give us the direction to fulfill all our desires. By following the Vedas, we can fulfill all our desires. So that's why the Vedas have been compared to a desire tree. Now, one may question, how is it possible? That also can be scientifically explained, like, you see, whatever we want in the material platform, for that we have to pay a price. Like, you may want, say you go to a shop and you may see a very nice, very beautiful diamond ring. Now, you want to have that diamond ring, but you can't have it unless you have the money to pay for that. Right? So, and if you have the money, if you have money, then you can have anything you desire in the material life. Apparently, money can buy practically any material object that is accessible to us. Now, money is called artha, or wealth, or asset, right? Now, money is actually gross asset. And it's actually, the more people are becoming materialistic, this asset, or this wealth, is becoming more and more gross, right? Like, in the past, the wealth was measured by gold. And still now, it is measured by gold. But gold is not used as a media of exchange. Proportionate to the amount of gold, different countries have printed currency. And that current, from gold, these currencies have become the medium of exchange, or artha, asset, wealth. Like, but we can see that currencies are actually just paper. These currencies don't have any value. But gold is what has the real value. Gold has the value, but not these papers. But because it has been accepted by everyone, although we know that these are just papers, but we also impose certain value, or we recognize the value of these papers that have been stamped by the state or government. But if the government is overthrown, then the currency won't have any value. Like if Pakistan attacks India and Indian government is overthrown, Pakistan takes over, then Indian currency will not have any value. Same thing applies to Russia and America and all the countries. And actually it's a fact. We can also see, like, the German currency, the pre-war German currency, don't have any value whatsoever. Once I got a bill of 10,000 Deutschmark, but from Hitler's time, and that one doesn't have any value. No one gives a damn about that. For everyone, it's just a piece of paper. It doesn't have any value whatsoever. And now we can see that it has become even more gross. The wealth has become even more gross. That is credit cards. I mean, you don't even have to have the money in your pocket, just show a piece of plastic, right? And people will recognize it. So we can see that more materialistic we are becoming, the grosser we become. Or rather, grosser we are becoming. But if we go to the subtle platform, then, of course, in the material platform, very subtle, the tangible material platform, in the tangible material platform, the subtle wealth is actually gold. That everybody recognizes. If you have gold, when the Indian government is in power, the gold has its value. And if the Chinese government comes and takes over India, still then the gold will have its value. Maybe the gold will have even more value then. The gold, value of gold is constant all over. Then even higher concept of wealth is what? There is even higher concept of wealth. Yeah. Very good. Punna. The piety. Pious activity. So, if you have pious activities, then this is the subtlest form of wealth in the material plane. If you have it, and if you desire something, immediately it will be fulfilled. Like Prabhupada used to give the example, why is someone born in a poor family? And this man struggles all his life, and he still remains poor. He works like a dog, but still at the end of his life, he is poor. But there is somebody who is just born in a rich family. He didn't do anything. Just by being born in a rich family, he becomes a millionaire. Like I remember when Ambarish had his son, immediately he wrote 2.5 million in his credit. Just gave him 2.5 million just as soon as the child was born. So just by birth, you know, somebody becomes a millionaire. And somebody works so hard, but still he remains poor all his life. So it's not that by hard work we become rich. So what is the criterion? The criterion is actually pious activities. If somebody has some pious activities, then he'll be born in a rich family. Why Bhagavad Gita says, Suchinam Sumatam Grehe. Yoga Prashta Abhijayana. A fallen yogis are born in a either in a very pure Brahmin's house or in a very rich Kshatriya or Vaishya's house. Why? Because by performing yoga, by rendering devotional service, this person has acquired a lot of piety. And due to his pious activities, or due to his pious assets, he is born in a rich family. So, the Vedas actually give you the direction how to become real rich, how to acquire this subtle wealth, punna. If you want to become a king of heaven, what do you need? You need a lot of punna. Right. So, Vedas give you the direction how to perform those punya or pious activities. Now, that section of the Vedas is known as Karma Kanda. How many Kandas are there in the Vedas?
Three.
What are they?
Karma Kanda, Jana Kanda.
Jnana Kanda.
Jnana, yeah.
And? Upasana Kanda. So, these are actually the progress, the successive progression, that from Karma Kanda is the very basic instructions of the Vedas. How to acquire piety? And why does one wants to acquire piety? Why does one want to acquire piety?
Power.
Because one wants to enjoy. Right? Everybody wants to enjoy. Is there anyone who doesn't want to enjoy? I don't think so. Everyone wants to enjoy, and that's why we are here.
But this kind of enjoyment is not material desires.
Yes, but this enjoyment that we are talking about is material desire. Everybody wants to enjoy. When somebody is on a material platform, he wants to enjoy out of matter, right? Through matter. And when somebody is situated in the spiritual platform, he wants to enjoy through the spirit or supreme spirit, right? Like, we didn't come here to suffer, did we? We came here to enjoy. And we realized that there is actually no enjoyment in the material platform. And then by reading Prabhupada's books, we got to know that the real enjoyment is in the spiritual nature. And that's why we are trying to go back to the spiritual nature. Now, a gross materialistic person who is simply limited by his senses, he wants to enjoy and he has these desires constantly coming up in his mind. I want money, I want fame, I want so and so forth. So one wants so many things for enjoyment. And then the Vedas gives him the direction. Okay, you want to enjoy? Act like this. Perform such and such activities. The example can be given. Parents send the children to the school. Why? Because when somebody studies in a school and then goes to the university, then he makes his future very bright. He gets more enjoyment, or he's supposed to get more enjoyment by studying well or developing different qualities. But an intelligent man, like you all, at certain point realize that there is no enjoyment in the material platform. One considers that I want to enjoy, and I'm making so many endeavors. I'm trying so hard to enjoy, and I'm even getting the objects of my enjoyment. But still, why I'm not happy? One questions like that, I'm sure you all questioned yourselves too. That why I'm not enjoying? I don't want to suffer, but still why suffering comes? I do not invite suffering. I do not work hard to suffer, but still suffering comes. And that's the... That's what Prahlad Maharaj told. And Prabhupada actually emphasized that point. Does anyone work hard to suffer? No one. Then where does the suffering come from? From according to one's own karma. Right? Previous, from destiny. Or according to the destiny. And so if suffering comes without struggling, then happiness also will come without struggling. I don't have to work hard for happiness or enjoyment. It will come on its own, according to our previous activities. But a real intelligent man will understand that there is no enjoyment in the material platform. Now, this Karmakanda section of the Vedas gives direction how to enjoy. But when one realizes that there is no enjoyment in the material platform, then he begins to wonder why. And that why actually leads him to the next platform known as Gyanakanda. And then, at the end of Gyanakanda, he realizes that there is another platform beyond Gyanakanda that is known as Upasana Kanda. So Vedas have three Kandas. Kanda means actually main branches. The tree of the Vedic tree has three main branches. Karma Kanda, Gyanakanda and Upasanakanda. And these three branches have been explained by six philosophers known as Short Darshan. Short means six, Darshan means philosophy. Anyone knows those six branches of philosophy?
Pantanjali.
Huh?
Pantanjali is one.
Patanjali is one of the philosophers. Gautama is one of the philosophers. Patanjali is also a philosopher. Jaimini is also a philosopher.
Purana
is no supplementary of the Vedas. Karma Mimamsa, right. The Karma Mimamsa or Purva Mimamsa covers what? Branch of the Vedic literature. Vedic. Which branch is covered by Karma Mimamsa?
Karmakanda.
Very good. And what does Karma Mimamsa mean? Karma Mimamsa?
That one was just
one. Mimamsa means what? I discussed it in my previous class. You remember?
I don't remember the word, but isn't that philosophy that you just work and then you get the result?
Yeah. What's the meaning of the word Mimamsa? Mimamsa means conclusion. And it's actually known as Purva Mimamsa or preliminary conclusion. So what is the preliminary conclusion of the Vedas?
Good action leads to good results.
Very good. Good action leads to good results, or good action leads to enjoyment, and bad action leads to suffering. So everyone must do good. Everyone must act nicely. Right? And so Vedas have explained that. But then the question arises that I have been trying so hard, and in my whole life I did not do any bad action. But still, why did I get old? Still, why am I dying? Why am I diseased? Now, why am I suffering? So all these questions automatically arise because in spite of one's endeavor to be happy, one inevitably ends up becoming miserable. And that's the time one questions, why is that? My father told me if I went to the university and got a PhD, then I'll be a very successful man and I'll get everything I want. So I have become a PhD, but so why am I suffering? Right? An intelligent man will question like that. So that question leads to the platform of Gyanakanda. Gyana means knowledge. And this branch has four different philosophies. Four different branches of philosophy. Four different philosophies actually covering this branch of the Vedas known as Karmakanda, Gyanakanda. And those philosophies are? And then? Yoga. Very good. And they are actually gradual elevation from one to the other. Naya, what does Naya mean?
Logic.
Logic. And what is the business of logic? To come to a conclusion by questioning. I do not want to suffer. Why am I suffering? So logically you get the answer. Why am I suffering? And they actually gone through a whole lot of philosophical speculations. And then ultimately they came to the conclusion that there are 21 reasons of suffering. I mentioned that also, I think. 21 reasons of suffering. Huh? First one is body. We have the body and that's where we are suffering. If we... You see, all the sufferings are actually inflicted on our body. Anyway, I don't want to get into elaborate discussion on that. But in the previous class, last time I gave the class on this verse, I elaborately discussed. And so there are various reasons of suffering. The first one is body, then the six senses, then six objects of the senses, then six working senses, and six kinds of growth in the material direction, then growth. You grow. Right? So 18 plus 1, 19. And the 20th consideration was suffering is the cause of, the happiness is the cause of suffering. The concept of happiness is there. That's where the concept of suffering is there. Right? If there was no happiness, then there wouldn't have been any suffering. And then suffering itself is the cause of suffering. So,
I have one question. Like, for you said that everyone wants to enjoy, even when not materialistic, wants to enjoy the spiritual, the spirit, no? But what about, like, you said that the gopis, they even don't want to enjoy spiritual life, they just want to give pleasure to Krishna.
Yeah, they want to give pleasure to Krishna, but by doing that, they automatically become joyful. Right?
Well, they don't have interest.
At the back of one's mind, when one is suffering, at the back of his mind, he has the natural desire to enjoy. Because constitutionally, we are joyful. So if that state of joy is not there, then immediately we begin to hanker for that. It's a natural thing. Right? So our constitutional position is to be joyful. Is to enjoy.
They don't understand this explanation that I said that they
anyway, you think it over. Like, I mean, it's a very common thing, very simple thing. And I don't, you know, like, time is over. I want to finish this class quickly. I mean, who will doubt that? I asked, who wants to suffer? Do you want to suffer? You don't want to suffer. That means you want to enjoy. Right? But when you are situated in a state of enjoyment, then you do not separately desire for enjoyment. You understand? Like when you already have it, say, when you have $1,000,000, then you do not want money, right? You want something else, right? Then you don't say that, well, give me money, because you already have it. You're already situated in that, you know, state. But then you develop these different objects. The same way the gopis are situated in a state of enjoyment. But then they also know, being situated in a state of enjoyment, they know where the enjoyment actually comes from. They know that the enjoyment actually comes from Krishna. And that's why they simply want to serve Krishna. Right? They want to give pleasure to Krishna. And by giving pleasure to Krishna, they become joyful. Prabhupada used to give an example. The mother does not want to be joyful, right? You'll notice that the most extrovert girl, right? When she becomes a mother, she stops going to the movies, going to socialize, and she just stays at home taking care of her child, right? Why is that? Because she derives the real joy out of taking care of her child. When the child is happy, she feels happy. Because child is an extension of herself, a physical self, right? So who is Krishna? Krishna is actually an extension of herself, spiritual self. I am Krishna's. So when I become related to Krishna with that understanding, Krishna is an extension of myself, then automatically through Krishna's enjoyment, we become joyful. Then we do not separately want enjoyment. Clear? Then Naya leads to the next branch of philosophy called Vaisheshika. Vaisheshika leads to the next branch of philosophy called Sankha or analytical study. And then that leads to the next branch known as Yoga. And what is the object of Yoga? Objective of Yoga philosophy? to be linked up with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the objective of yoga is to become linked up to link up with Krishna. And in the perfect stage of yoga, what does one experience? What does one attain at the perfect stage of yoga?
Samadhi.
What is the samadhi?
Become absorbed in the spiritual life.
Become?
Absorbed in the spiritual life and serving the love of God.
Quite close. Become absorbed, and what is the spiritual, what is the object, what is actually the spiritual nature or spiritual life? You wanted to say something? The center of spiritual nature is Krishna. Right? So being absorbed, actually the yogis do not see Krishna. They see Krishna's extension, Krishna's manifestation in our heart. And what is that manifestation? Purusha,
Paramahansa.
I see. What is Krishna? What is Krishna's extension in our heart? Paramahansa. Very good. Paramatma, super soul. Now, we are spirit souls, and Krishna is the super soul, right? Lord is the super soul. So when this minute spirit soul perceives the super soul, the supreme personality, then naturally he becomes humble, isn't it? Because the natural tendency of a living entity to be humble in front of someone who is great. Now Krishna is the greatest, super soul is the greatest, and when the jiva soul comes across the spirit soul, the super soul, then he feels very humble. He, in the light of his greatness, he perceives his minuteness. And then he automatically feels like surrendering himself to Krishna or super soul. And that surrender is known as prapatti or sharanagati. And this surrender actually is the beginning of devotional service. So this is how one transcends Gyanakanda platform and comes to the Upasanakanda or worshipping platform. The platform of worshipping. And then when he worships the Lord, then ultimately when the Lord becomes pleased with him, then he reveals his identity to him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, Jam Shyam Sundaram, Achintya Guna Swarupam, Govindam, Adi Purusham. And there, so this Upasana Kanda has been analyzed or explained by what philosophy? You were there in that class, right?
Yeah.
Been a bad boy. Bruce, you were there in that class? None of you are here. None of you are there. Who remembers? Huh? Go ahead. That's right. Uttar Mimamsa or final conclusion. And what is the final conclusion? Yes. And the final conclusion is actually Vedanta Sutra. And the the Vedanta Sutra elaborated or explained is Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's how we can see that how Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Kalpa Vriksha, desire tree of the Vedic literature. Is it clear now? That fruit had been blended with the nectar from the lotus mouth of Sukadev Goswami, and how the great personalities like yourselves relish that. So thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Is there any question?
Can you say that the six philosophers, the six philosophers, related, the six philosophers related with each one of the six philosophers?
Not those philosophers. Out of the six, actually five of them are atheistic. And it's not that they are the propounders of the philosophy. Actually everything is existing, eternal. But they put their name, they put a stamp. Like Kapila, the Devahuti's son, Kapila, is the compiler of the Shankha philosophy. But later on, an atheistic philosopher called Kapila came. And he claimed, he wrote his Sankhya philosophy. They are actually cheats. The original thing is in the spiritual sky. Right? But some, you know, like some unscrupulous people have put their name and contaminated the whole concept. So these are all actually atheistic concepts. Because all these five philosophies do not accept God. The ultimate consideration for Karma Mimamsa, Purva Mimamsa, are the demigods. Naya ultimately, you know, says that everything is nothing. Right? Same thing with Vaisheshika, everything is atom. These atheistic concepts. None of them actually accept God. But the positive Sankha, so it's interesting to consider here, the atheistic Sankha analyzes. The Sankhya philosophy is the analytical study, right? The atheistic Sankhya is analyzing the whole material creation. How did they analyze? There are five elements in the material nature. We have five senses, right? And then when the senses interact with the objects of the these elements of the material nature, then five objects of the senses are produced, right? Three fives are 15, right? And then there are five working senses. 4 5s are 20, and then there are three subtle elements, mind, intelligence and false ego, 23, and then the basic ingredient of the creation, Mahatattva, right? 24. And this Mahatattva is the vikara of Brahma, so ultimately Sarvam Khandinam Brahma. All atheistic. But no, I didn't finish. Let me finish this point. But what did the Vedic the Vaishnava philosophers, how did they shut them up or outsmarted them? You know? They raised the question that all these 24 considerations are actually objective in nature. They're objective, right? But objects cannot exist without the subject, right? Now what is the subject? What's the subject? Oh, no, you didn't raise your hand. I thought you raised your hand.
So,
right. I am here, that's why the 24 elements are manifest. If I'm not here, then they won't be existing. If you're not here, will it exist for you?
No.
Right? So, if no one is here, will this material nature be manifest? It's a big question. Anyway, the understanding is that the material, this nature is manifest because I am here. Right? So this I is the 25th consideration. And in Sanskrit, the I is Atma. I is called.
But the subject is not Krishna. The subject is not Krishna.
What?
Because material manifestation didn't become manifest because of Krishna's desire.
Anyway, I mean, don't get into that. Try to understand what I'm saying. I'm just presenting how the Vaishnava philosophers defeated the Sankhya philosophy. They raised the question, all these 24 considerations are objective in nature, right? So can objects exist without the subject? It cannot. Now what is the subject? The subject is I. The I in Sanskrit is Atma, right? Or spirit soul, right? Now, so the 25th consideration is I, and this I could not be, whole material nature has been analyzed by this 24 considerations, but nowhere this I could be found. So I obviously is not material. So that means I is non-material, that is I is spiritual. Atma or spirit or the soul is spiritual. Right? And then they consider that this I or the Atma is minute and many. Minute and many has to have an origin or a source. Right? So what is the source? What is the source of all these Atmas or spirit soul? Super soul. So the 26th consideration is the super soul. And by doing that, they transcended the material nature and took it to the spiritual nature. Vaishnavas are very smart. It is said, Jaijan Krishna Bhaje Shevara Chotu. One who worships Krishna is very smart, very cunning. So Mayavadis tremble when they are confronted with the devotees. Yes.
Yeah.
There is growing, strong, growing beautiful, growing big, growing famous.
No.
No. That's like you grow big. And then you begin to shrink, right? How many years did I say?
Four.
Growing strong, growing beautiful, growing
famous,
growing growing rich. Growing wealthy. So all that, you know, pulls us towards the material direction. Right? That's the growth. Somebody has a big body like John's, like Jagannath's. What actually is the matter? He collected a lot of matter. Right? That's the growth in the material direction. Or somebody acquired a lot of money. It's a kind of a growth in the material direction. Somebody became very famous. It's a growth in that direction. And the understanding is, the more you grow in that direction, the more miserable you become.
So a short person never made
that. Yes, it's true actually. Because if you have a big body to carry, can you imagine what a big burden it is for the spirit? When you're young, it's all right. But when you grow old, when you don't have any control over your body, it's miserable.
That's why, like, most yogis are real thin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why is there in the purport of the 5th or 6th verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada explains that in order to sit in the Vyasasana, one must become conversant all these 5th, 6th of the Lord. I think
towards the beginning, right. That's because, you see, the understanding is that unless and until one has taken shelter of Srimad Bhagavatam, one should not speak. Right? Only a speaker of Bhagavatam can sit on a Vyasasana. Right? And Bhagavatam is actually the conclusion of all the different branches of this. You do not have to separately study them. Punna, there are two kinds of punnas, material punna and the spiritual punna. Punna is known as what? It has a specific Sanskrit word. Madamadri, you know?
Pass?
No. You know. Sukriti.
Yeah.
The spiritual piety is known as Sukriti. You have a question? Did you raise your hand?
Yeah.
You are about to.
I was going to ask him, it would take him much longer, but how about Chaitanya's philosophy of Chintya?
Actually, this Upasana Kanda and Srimad Bhagavatam has been finally, you know, has been perfectly manifest or got its perfected shape through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You know, there are two concepts, same and different. One and different, right? And there are arguments that some would say, some philosophers said that ultimately everything is one. And others said, no, no. Ultimately everything is variegated. So there was an eternal conflict. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came and summed it up. How? Achinto bheda bheda. Inconceivably, one and different. Same and different. Philosophy. That is the essence of the Upasana Kanda. The essence of Srimad Bhagavatam. The essence of all the Vaishnava literature.
I heard it's beyond the Upasana Kanda. Sometimes I heard it's
The essence is actually beyond, right? You take the milk, you take the butter out of milk. Is the butter with the milk anymore?
No,
it's beyond the milk.
Also, isn't it that the scientists, non-material scientists, need to feed them in the same way as the philosophers feed his atheists? Exactly the same way, actually. They also say, they also come down with material elements and forget about the spirit soul.
They forget about the spirit. So they're like the Sankhya philosophers.
We tell them also that we don't know where they come from. We don't know who is coming.
Right.
It's the same.
I think I'll stop now. Because, I can go on. Because I won't take prasadam before 2:30. But you may not have prasad left. Because the other day devotees complained that there was no prasadam left for latecomers.
It's just about Jainism. Kind of
it's an atheism, Buddhism, kind of Buddhism, voidism.
Where they walk naked.
Huh?
They walk naked.
What they?
They walk in the streets naked. Naked.
Naked.
Yeah.
They think that's the way to become free from material attachments.
Hare Krishna.
I didn't get your name. I took the names of the devotees who gave the paper, submitted the paper. Oh, that's his name.
In the English institution that does this kind of study on a more permanent level.
We had a whole month long course here.
Yeah. Same thing.
That part you thought there is nothing? No, it's finished.
This is finished at the end of the course. Anyway, next year you can come.
Okay. 1 month for
Kartik? I have something to tell
you. Yeah, there'll be announcements in every temple.
Really?
Every temple knew about this.
Oh, nice.
This what this do you use? Five inches? Oh, you're working on Guru Temple?
Yeah. You said that we can feel humble if we feel the presence of a higher spirit like this. So, how can we become humble when we don't feel the presence of the super soul?
Hare Krishna. Well, at least to begin with, you can become humble to the Vaishnavas. Hare Krishna.
There is no harm in becoming.
No harm in trying to become humble. Right? When you try, because there is a matter of understanding that by being humble, you can actually gain. Right? You gain by being humble.
Hare Krishna.